Due to the graphic nature of some of the content in this episode, listener discretion is advised. Those who know me could tell you that planning ahead is not usually one of my strong suits. That lack of forethought has gotten me in trouble before. It's a bit of a flaw, something I always plan to work on. But to quote a friend, the world is a hostile environment. Reality tends to throw curveballs. And when it does, I've found the propensity to plan is much less important than our ability to adapt. My name is Freddie, and this is Unforgotten, a podcast tangled in a web of subtext and abstraction. The unsolved murder of Matt Stewart.
Back in June, a husband and a wife were asleep in their upstairs bedroom here when a stranger came in, brutally attacked, and killed the husband. Now, the wife was able to...
I find that a little difficult to believe, just considering how much of a fight he gave.
It was like the person who did it was almost like they knew what they were doing.
It was personal.
They're not going to intimidate me out of doing this.
Right now, we just really have nothing solid to go on.
There's no hidden lies.
If you go looking into the murder of Matt Stewart online, there's something that lunges out of the search engine right away. A series of headlines about a spree killer who claimed the lives of five innocent people outside Gaffney, South Carolina in the span of just 8 days during the summer of 2009. His reign of terror was brought to a sudden end on July 6th after early morning gunfire in Dallas, North Carolina. But just as soon as authorities were convinced they had their guy, speculation into the possible connection between these killings and the murder of Matt Stewart began swirling. When I set out to do this project, I recognized that the Gaffney killings would be a topic I'd have to cover. So months ago, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request for documents related to this case from the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, and I began scouring the internet for hours, looking for anything I could find on Patrick Tracy Burris. Patrick Burris was born in Maryland in 1967, but he grew up primarily around Reidsville, North Carolina, and he grew up to be a pretty big guy, standing at 6'7" and weighing 285 pounds. Burris's large stature eventually earned him the nickname Big Country, which he later had tattooed on his arm. His life of crime began in his late teens. Over the next two decades, his rap sheet was ever expanding. He collected felony convictions in four different states in the categories of larceny, breaking and entering, forgery, armed robbery, and blackmail, to name a few. He had spent the last 7.5 years behind bars in a correctional facility in Lincoln County, North Carolina, until being released in April of 2009. Burris's exact whereabouts on June 9th of that year are unknown, at least to me and everyone else I've spoken with. But reportedly, at this time, Burris was still participating in the work release program in which he was a tree trimmer for a landscaping company out of Lincoln County. People I've spoken with have suggested that this job placed Burris in Mooresville around the time of Matt's murder, but that's not something I've been able to verify. What is confirmed is that 3 days after Matt's murder, Burris was arrested in Lincoln County for driving with a revoked license. He had been living with his girlfriend down the street, and her son promptly bailed him out of jail. But after he was bailed out, Burris didn't go back to living with his girlfriend, nor did he return to the work release program. Like so much of this story, the details around what happened next are a bit fuzzy. But at some point, Burris met two new friends at a bar, a brother and sister from nearby Gaston County, and the three of them descended into a drug binge that lasted for weeks, camped out in a dilapidated house owned by the siblings' mother, which was located off Spencer Mountain Road in Dallas, North Carolina. The house hadn't been lived in for years, and the power and utilities had long been cut off. The siblings are reported to have described Burris as a secretive character. They told of how he'd inexplicably go absent for long periods of time. But by early July, the siblings claim Burris had become noticeably fixated on a certain topic circulating in the local news: the recent series of murders in Gaffney, South Carolina, and the growing hunt for the killer. On June 27th, Gaffney area peach farmer Cash Klein was found shot to death in his home. He had last been seen alive that afternoon, talking with a tall stranger who showed up at his house to buy hay. 4 days later, a local grade school teacher, Gina Parker, and her mother, Hazel Linder, were found bound and shot to death in their Cherokee County home, just a few miles from where Klein had been killed. While investigators matched the ballistics to the first murder, they were unable to prevent what happened next. Just 2 days later, Steven Tyler, a 48-year-old business owner, was found shot to death inside his downtown Gaffney store. His 15-year-old daughter, Abby, was also injured in the attack. She was airlifted to the hospital, but died just days later as a result of her injuries. She was only 15 years old. As fear and panic swelled around this small, otherwise peaceful South Carolina community, Patrick Tracy Burris is said to have kept a watchful eye on the media coverage.
Five people have been shot to death in little more than a week in the town of Gaffney.
A serial killer has targeted the city of just 13,000 people.
The manhunt continues this morning for a suspected serial killer terrorizing a small town.
The same person has killed all these people. He's been at all the crime scenes, so they're linked that way. But
investigators say all the victims were bound and shot.
These victims are targeted randomly.
Every time somebody opens a door, they're carrying a gun.
To get a better sense of how the next part of this saga unfolded, I reached out to Graham Cuzia, a former officer with the Gaston County Police Department.
So I was hired by Gaston County Police in 2008. So I was full-time for like 4.5, almost 5 years. So I served both on patrol and then as a detective in criminal investigation. So I worked homicides and major crimes. And then I served as a reserve officer part-time for a couple of years, and then taught at the American Academy of Applied Forensics.
If you wouldn't mind kind of taking me through what happened that evening.
So I had been on patrol by myself, at least independent patrol, for only a month or two. I was a brand new, fresh out of the academy patrol officer. July 6, 2009, super early in the morning, 4th of July weekend. As you can imagine, that's a super busy time for police departments on patrol. We had worked all weekend. I was on night shift at the time, so we worked 12-hour shifts. So I was at the end of my three-day cycle. So yeah, it was around 2 a.m. We got a call for a breaking and entering in progress where a neighbor had reported that they saw someone entering a vacant house across the street. I responded to it and was the first one there, and then two other officers on my squad also responded as backup. Think of a house in a horror movie. That's exactly what this looked like. That looked like it hadn't been lived in for years. The grass was like 3 feet tall. There's no power in the house, so all the lights were off. It was a really dark night, pitch black. So I remember actually talking to one of my partners on the computer right when the call came out, and I asked her, is this a priority one call? Because it was a vacant house, breaking and entering middle of the night. But because the house was vacant, I asked her, is this a priority one call? Meaning, is this something I need to go light the siren to? And she responded back, you know, priority three, which is, you know, get there, but it's not a life-threatening emergency yet. I can't remember exactly what I was thinking, but it was probably like, okay, there's probably some kids having an underage drinking party or something like that. I wasn't overly concerned. So when I pulled up to the house, there was a Ford Explorer in the driveway, two people standing outside, and then one person in the Ford Explorer. As soon as I pulled up, I saw people there, and they didn't respond like they shouldn't have been there. They didn't run, or they didn't get startled. At that point, I started talking to them, and it was a brother and sister, and they said, hey, we own this house. So I had dispatch validate, hey, yes, these IDs match up to the people in our system. So nothing like that was super concerning to me. The only thing that was weird is I didn't know who the other person in the vehicle was, who didn't get out of the vehicle, which I guess, look, hindsight does look a little odd now. So my partner, actually, Catherine Williamson, approached the vehicle to get his ID to figure out what his story was. Why wasn't he out talking to his friends?
And how did he react to that?
When she came back, she said, something's not right with this guy. I'm going to go check him in the system. He seemed to either be lying or something when he was giving his name and birth date. Like, he was trying to think of a fake name and birth date, and it raised her flag. So she went back to her computer, and so they went inside the house, and we were standing at Catherine's car. She said, I think this is him. And it showed his picture, looked like him, and it said, like, height, like, 6'6" or 6'7", 280 pounds. And this guy was huge when he got out of the car. So So we were pretty confident it was him. The face looked like him, and he had a warrant out for a probation violation, which would explain why you would give a fake name, fake date of birth. As soon as that popped up, we confirmed that with dispatch. It was a local probation violation. It wasn't like federal. It wasn't for like murder or anything like that that we know of.
So at this point, you're still kind of routine.
Right. We get those all the time. So not a big deal. But he was a big guy, way bigger than all of us. And he seemed a little intoxicated. It was a 4th of July weekend, Sunday, 3 o'clock in the morning, grappling with someone that big who's maybe high or drunk is not a fun thing to do in the middle of the night in a house with no power. We're going to go inside the house and go pick him up. So we went up to the front door, but this guy was massive. So I was like, hey, I've got my taser out just in case he won't comply. Jim knocked on the door, and the brother and sister answered the door. Jim said something like, hey, where's your buddy or where's your friend? And they pointed in that first room where the front door was. They pointed to the couch. We entered the house. They moved out of the way. And if you can picture a little tiny living room and a couch along the wall, he was laying on the couch, face towards the wall, so he couldn't see it. And he had his hands kind of underneath his head, underneath the pillow, pretending to sleep. Pretending to sleep. So Jim said, hey, I need to talk to you. Show me your hands, stand up. And he didn't do that. Jim repeated it, made a grunting sound, like a, don't wake me up kind of thing. By that time, we told him, you know, several times, three or four times, show us your hands, stand up. You know, we got a warrant for your arrest, put your hands behind your back. And the guy was not complying, but he was moving around and making noise, so we knew he was awake. Pointed my taser at him, flipped it on so that the red dot was on where the probes would deploy to. In the middle of Jim saying, you know, stand up, you're under arrest, put your hands behind your back. He reached over his shoulder and blindly fired the pistol and shot Jim in the leg while he was laying down. So he blind fired over his shoulder and then tried to turn around so he could see us. I had my taser in my hand already, not a gun. So I pulled the trigger on my taser, which the probes attached to him and started to tase him. I remember already having my finger on the trigger of the taser because he wasn't obeying our commands and he wasn't showing us our hands. He was hiding underneath the pillow. Turns out he had a gun under the pillow, which is why he wouldn't show it to us. It happened very fast. After he fired that shot and I deployed the taser, I was standing, you know, 2 feet from him. We all were. So we all dove for cover. Jim fell down because he just got shot. I dove out of the way because I'm holding a taser, not a gun. I'm going to lose that fight every time. I dove into the doorway, threw my taser on the ground, and pulled my pistol out. So the taser's going click, 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 like still making the zapping noise on the floor, bouncing around. That's the only light in the room besides the flashlights because there's no power in the house. That first shot, I guess it made me temporarily deaf because it was so loud in that room. So by the time I got my gun out and got aim on him, he had already been shot several times, and both Jim and Catherine had shot him. See that? His hand was open. I could see the gun. He was laying on the couch. He started wheezing at that point for his breath. So immediately after I saw that he had been shot, he was not a huge threat to us at the moment, even though he still had his gun in his hand. Thought process was, oh crap, I've got this brother and sister behind me. They might have guns too. I grabbed them. I put the brother on the ground, ordered the sister to come out, lay on the ground, and held them at gunpoint while Catherine held the suspect, the shooter, at gunpoint. And Jim crawled out of the front of the house. And then we started yelling for backup on the phone and for ambulances. That's when everyone responded.
You said Jim crawled out. Was he in critical condition or?
The whole circumstances, if you believe in divine intervention, so Jim had a pocket knife in his left pocket, and the bullet ricocheted off the pocket knife instead of entering his femoral artery and shattering his femur, traveled down the skin of his leg, inside the skin of his leg. So he was bleeding and he had a wound, but it didn't hit any arteries, didn't hit bone. It was a tissue wound after that. What's even more incredible is that Catherine's bullet, the first bullet that she's fired, went down the barrel of the shooter's gun and jammed it, so he couldn't shoot anymore. We couldn't do that if you tried 100,000 times again. Like, I didn't know if there was more people in the house. So as soon as our backup there, we grabbed the brother and sister, got them out of the house, and then had to clear the rest of the house before we could, you know, you always administer first aid, if possible. But if there's other possible threats in the house, I can't obviously turn my back to them. So once backup got there, we cleared through the whole house. That'd been... We were out in the middle of nowhere, Dallas, North Carolina, right on the border. It was a good 10 minutes before anyone got there. We were able to clear the house, 10, 15 minutes. And then by that time, he had already passed.
So when was it that you all realized who he was?
I had no idea until the next day. It, you know, we you have to give statements and everything to your police department and to FBI anytime police officers involved in a shooting. But we gave our statements. We went home. The little sleep that we did have, we turned our phones off, but we didn't get home till like 9 or 10 o'clock in the next morning, and we worked all weekend. So I remember I woke up the next day, and my phone had justifiably a billion calls and a billion missed text messages. But I believe the FBI had validated while I was asleep that the bullets in the gun matched the same bullets that were used in the murders in South Carolina, and his vehicle matched that description. I think they said there were some articles in the vehicle that matched things they were looking for, essentially.
You guys were the one that took him down. What do you remember feeling at that time?
You know, it's kind of surreal. But we went from being, you know, rural county police in the middle of nowhere, North Carolina, to be on every national news channel, international news. People were sending me screenshots like BBC in England, senators calling and writing us letters. That was pretty cool to see the community outreach and just to see how relieved, you know, Gaffney, South Carolina was afterwards. Because that town, we were reading about it in the news. We never thought we'd have anything to do with it, but they were paralyzed with fear. Probably the coolest thing I remember hearing is Gaston County Police sent one of our new Dodge Chargers, our March patrol cars, down there for their parade. And they said when they came back, every single person stand up and cheered and screamed when that Gaston County Police car rolled down the middle of the street for the parade. So that was pretty cool. We'd heard stories that, you know, he was probably going to kill the brother and sister that were at the house that night and take their cars because his vehicle description was on the news.
Was there any talk at all of other local unsolved murders or crimes that people suspected?
Yeah, so I remember hearing about it on the news and people talking that they were looking into it for other murders, but I never heard of any that were substantiated, and I really had no insight except really what I saw on the news.
If Burris had been the unidentified intruder in Matt Stewart's house, it would mean that Matt was his first of six victims. Ultimately, this would make Burris not a spree killer, but a full-blown serial killer. On the surface, it's easy to see why this possibility was so closely examined by investigators and the press. Burris had just been released from prison weeks before in a neighboring county. His confirmed victims were all killed seemingly at random, often in their own homes. When I started researching earlier this year, nothing I could find online indicated that Burris had ever been ruled out for Matt's murder, though I found several articles which confirmed that the Mooresville Police Department had been looking into the Burris possibility, but I could never find any follow-ups. As you've heard in earlier episodes, when I talked with friends and family close to the case, they said they were still unsure as to whether Burris was ever ruled out. Last episode, Pastor Wicker even indicated that some individuals in law enforcement still like Burris for this crime. So I was a bit taken off guard a few weeks ago when a librarian friend of mine dug up old news articles from August of 2009, which contained an announcement that the Mooresville Police Department had determined no connection between Burris and the murder on Shepherd's Hill Drive. I wondered why that announcement hadn't made a larger impact. You'd think someone would have mentioned it by now. After reviewing the files from the Freedom of Information Act, I spotted some clear differences between Burris's confirmed murders and Matt Stewart's. I spoke more about it with Graham Cuzia.
Spree killers like Burris do have certain MOs and certain ways of doing things. So he was trying to steal, essentially get money or things he could pawn to buy drugs. He was a drug addict, and during the time of our shooting, he was on a cocaine binge. I'm not super familiar with the case that you're investigating, but those are things I'd look at if the weapon type
right.
was the same, with the same caliber and the same MO. And Burris,
in all of the murders, he used the 25 caliber pistol. The motivation for the crime seemed to be money and drug related, whereas Matt Stewart, the MO seems completely different. From what I've heard from you and from people that have described Burris, does not strike me as someone that would be methodological in doing this kind of thing.
Burris carried a 25 caliber pistol, not a 40 or a 38 like the ones used to kill Matt. Evidence collected from Burris suggested a clear motivation for his killings. From every one of his victims, he took valuables, reportedly to fuel his drug addiction. None of Burris's victims were stabbed or shot with multiple guns, as Matt was. And all of Burris's victims appear to have been killed in the afternoon, not late at night, as was the situation in Mooresville. Though the MO is completely different, and law enforcement seemed to have determined no connection, Big Country still casts a long and haunting shadow over this case, as if it wasn't dark enough already. In June, I began having regular conversations with folks who live in the Gabriel Estates neighborhood, and it seemed like every time I talked with someone, they'd give me a list of other people to reach out to. Of those I could connect with, some were willing to go on record, while others weren't. Some of the key individuals in these accounts proved impossible to reach. Eventually, I decided it was high time I took a trip back to North Carolina to see if I could meet up with any of these folks face to face. When I arrived in the Gabriel Estates neighborhood, I rendezvoused with one of the neighbors who I had spoken with over the phone. This person walked me down the street to where all of this happened. She introduced me to a woman who had been the Stewart's neighbors for years, up until Matt's death. She agreed to be interviewed for this podcast. We sat and talked in her garage, and you can hear her grandchildren playing behind us in the driveway.
How does this podcast work? What do you do?
So it's on the internet.
Ashley? Okay. This is Freddie.
Hey. Hey there.
Nice
to meet you.
He's doing a podcast about Matt.
Oh, okay.
And I don't understand anything about podcasts.
What was it like being neighbors?
Just very nice people, good people. Always very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Can I help you do anything? They were always outside playing out in the back with the kids. Everybody was always happy about them being there. There's questions to be answered that make you wonder.
So you didn't hear anything that night?
Yeah.
I didn't hear a thing. My granddaughter Ashley had stayed at a friend's house, but also we had a dog, Duncan. Never heard him.
Do you think you would have heard the dog if it started barking?
Oh, yeah, because he's in my bedroom. So, and then, of course, next door, I believe their bedroom is...
Right next door.
Next door, you know, between us.
Did you ever talk with them about if
just
they heard anything?
Briefly, we did.
Uh-huh.
And he said they didn't hear anything. The dog didn't bark. I was woken up about 6:30 by the doorbell.
Dunkin' Donuts, yeah.
And I looked out, and it was a policeman. And just, my heart dropped because Ashley wasn't home. I says, "What's wrong?" He said, "Well, we've had an incident next door." No, all the police cars. We must have 9 or 10. What I was told was, and all of a sudden, she said she saw a shadow. And this is questions people ask. How in the world was she able to be getting out of that bed with the baby in her arms and get past that person? The question of how could she leave the baby there and go to the hospital? Well, maybe it was just a panic thing that you're not even thinking. You know, the doors closed, they said, and apparently she was sleeping. And so those are all questions that are still there. Her mother, but she was at home, I believe in Charlotte, that's where she lived, and she was watching TV or something, and she got a very strange feeling that there was something wrong, and she didn't feel safe in her house. So she got in her car about 12:30, 1 o'clock, something like that in the morning, and drove here.
She had a feeling? Like she felt unsafe in her own home?
She didn't feel safe at home. She wanted to get over here.
And you think she's the one that told you that?
Yeah, she is the one that told me.
She is the one that told you that?
Another thing that surprised everybody was she was able to get past all the emergency vehicles and stuff. She got herself in the driveway.
Really?
Apparently, the crime scene had already begun, but she was able to pull into Gabriel Estates, come up here, and pull right into their driveway while the police were here. Her car was parked there, and then it was confiscated, you know, for several days. Came over after they finally let her release her car, her truck, and all that stuff. She did come one day, and she was in there cleaning up that bathroom, which I've heard was just horribly bloody, and she came by over and asked me if I had something to help her clean with, and I think I did. And then she was still there later in the day, and I said something about, "Bet you're tired, you're glad to get home." "Oh, I'm not going home, I'm staying here and doing this."
did police spend much time going through the backyard?
Oh,
back
yeah,
there?
They brought in specialty dogs.
Did you hear anything about, like, confirming the path that they think this person took?
They didn't really know, is the last thing I heard.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, kind of thought he went that way, but...
Of course, police aren't going to say anything. If they do have something, they're going to keep it under wraps.
One of the police officers was telling me that the gas station has cameras. You know, they looked at all those cameras and everything. There was nothing on their cameras from the gas station, which would show somewhat over in this area. And they said they didn't see any activity.
So if this person did come from back there, they probably knew about the cameras. Whoever did this knew what they were doing, or it did not happen in the way that it was reported.
Supposedly how quickly that person disappeared. Last thing I heard was they thought he went in and out the back door, because that wasn't locked. Now, I heard they normally locked it, but it wasn't locked that night. You know, her computer was there, her purse was there, nothing was missing from the home is what we've heard. People came in, did what they did, and left.
They were there to do one thing.
Yeah, they had a purpose.
Earlier this week, back in Florida, while I had Graham on the phone, given his years of experience as a police detective, I figured I should pick his brain on some of the facts of Matt's case.
The examiner's report detailed two different caliber bullets. One was a 40 and one was a 38 that were found at the scene.
So a 40 caliber is going to be a semi-automatic pistol, which leaves shell casings. And a 38 is a revolver, which does not drop the shell casings when you fire it. So I don't know if they found any shells there. If there was a 40 shell not on the scene, if they never found it, it would mean the shooter picked it up and brought it with them.
What I've heard is that there were no shell casings at the scene.
And so that would make sense for a revolver, because they don't drop out. But if it was a semi-automatic, there would have been shell casings unless they picked
them up. Are there 40 caliber revolvers?
You know, for enough money, you can make anything in the world. So I'm sure out there someone has made one before, but it's not a super common thing if there are any. That's something maybe you could look into. If you think about it, right, if someone has time to clean up their shells, generally they're not super rushed. That's not a typical breaking, entering style. Most people don't remember to do that when they're not career criminals.
What's been significant talking with some of the neighbors is that no one heard any gunshots.
If it is a 38 revolver, that's not something you commonly make suppressors or silencers for. So I don't even know if they make them for that. Right. I would say if you have two different caliber weapons, you probably have two different suspects. It's very rare that someone's got a gun in each hand and is firing two hands. Plus, if that's the case, you can't stab someone if you've got a gun in each hand. Very, very rare that one person carries two weapons. I would tell you, if someone's got blunt force trauma, stab wounds, and two different types of calibers, that sounds clear as day as multiple shooters to me.
Speaking of curveballs, in my experience doing this podcast, I've caught a fair share.
Hey.
Do you have a second to talk?
Sure. You okay?
Yeah.
So I just got a phone call.
Uh-huh.
It was another unsettling one.
About the podcast?
Yeah, about the podcast. Apparently I'm putting the family in danger. And
how?
I don't know. It's just weird because 6 months ago, no one knew who did it at all.
Right.
It was like a complete mystery. And then now it's like I'm putting everyone in danger.
Because the person's out there.
This is what she said. The person's probably listening to the podcast.
What?
So how, like, the hell do you know that if you don't know
who did it?
Yeah. Because she said if I don't stop, there'll be serious repercussions.
Jeez.
And I said, would you mind explaining what you mean by that? She said, Freddie, I can't tell you.
What?
Yeah.
Are you scared?
I guess I'm supposed
to
be.
You seem a little bit.
I guess I'm supposed to be intimidated. So
what are you going to do?
I guess just keep going.
Next month, we'll release the final full-length episode of the year, but this new push to find closure for Matt's case is far from over. It's bigger than me, and it's bigger than this podcast. Expect the content and conversation to continue, Unforgotten is a Bold Era production, written and recorded by myself, Freddie Wilson, in the always sunny Daytona Beach, Florida, with audio production and backing tracks by myself and the ferociously charming Matt Garrett. Special thanks to Graham Kuzia and the wonderful folks in the Gabriel Estates neighborhood for their contributions to this episode. As always, this series is dedicated to the life of Matt Stewart. May his memory remain unforgotten.